because I could feel it through the residual bits of her magic, that he was gone. He didn't rot or turn to dust. He must have been very new, though, because he didn't even smell like a rotten corpse. He just smelled dead.
"So you see," said the English-speaking vampire very quietly, "abomination."
This time Mary heard him. She turned to him, her eyes cool. She said something.
"Why are you whispering to her, Kusurik?" she asked,
and he translated her words for me. "Kusurik." Kusurik was the master of the primary see, the Prague. So what was he doing on his knees in front of Mary? I wondered how long he'd been under her thumb. Libor should have paid more attention to the vampires in his city. Kusurik said something to her. Mary considered the kneeling vampire. She looked around and said something to the rest of the room.
"Who else speaks English here?" she asked,
and again he translated. No one volunteered. She said a word and closed her fingers briefly next to her mouth. He bowed his head and rose. When she walked up the old wooden stairs, he followed without looking back at me. Her train was a little lopsided without the human girl, but no one seemed to notice, except for me. She stopped at the top of the landing.
"He says that your mate convinced the Lord of Night that your death will cause a war between the Werewolf King and Buon Arata's people. He asked me not to kill you just yet, until he can check it out."
She smiled, and this time it was a kind of joyous smile that made her plain face beautiful.
"But he will let me know shortly, and in the meantime, I am welcome to enjoy myself. I am busy just now, but look for me in a few hours. I've never gotten to play with one of your kind before."
They left the two bodies where they were. They weren't the only dead in that basement. A city as old as Prague, a place as old as this building, has a lot of ghosts. And the dead of this part of Prague had witnessed Mary's visit. Now they, like me, turned their attention to the other monster who had waited while those who could not see the dead conducted their business. Almost an hour earlier, when I'd reached for Adam, hoping that somehow our link would function as it should, that somehow I could find him, let him know that I needed him, that I loved him, that I was scared and alone, I'd felt something touch my bond with Adam and slide away, unable to penetrate, to get inside of me or my bond. Instead, whoever it was used our bond to slide through the witch's spells and into the basement where I was held. It was different than it had been before. Its presence was even bigger. I could feel its magic, unfamiliar and familiar at the same time, and it flowed through me like an electric current as all around us ghosts stirred. There were a lot of ghosts. The vampire on the wall had drawn a breath to scream again, but instead he fell silent, as if he could sense the golem's presence. He flattened against the wall and turned his face away from us. The biggest difference between the first time I met the golem and this time was that it spoke to me.
"Mercy," said the golem in my head.
It didn't really use my name, not as such, but an identifier that was more who I was than my own name could convey. Its magic felt like... I swallowed when I figured out why some of it felt familiar. It felt like Hwaiota, the volcano god who had almost killed me not so long ago. My ankles still ached before storms. I'd lived with magic my whole life, and not in a happy Harry Potter sort of way either. Sure, magic worked by rules, but those rules were flexible, and different kinds of magic worked differently, and there were lots of different kinds of people and creatures who could access certain aspects of it. So there was pack magic, vampire magic, witch magic, wizard magic, fey magic, sorcerer magic. Me? I had a bare thread of magic. I could shift into a coyote. I was a walker, descendant of the avatars who represented the animals to the native peoples of the American continents. Among other things, our jobs, back before the European invasion and their attendant diseases nearly wiped the native peoples off the planet, had been to attend the spirits of the dead. For that reason, as best as I could piece it together, The magic of the dead did not affect me, and the influence worked the other way around. But the dead golem's presence had amped my attraction for ghosts up to maximum, until I'd been swimming in ghosts. If there was any question that it had been my encounter with the spirit of the golem that had been responsible, the effect of its presence here answered that. With it in the cellar, ghosts were flooding in despite the presence of vampires. Ghosts didn't like vampires. I'd once thought it was because the vampires had killed them. But then I learned that there are some vampire gifts that allow vampires to command ghosts, and other gifts that allow a vampire to consume them and use their substance for power. Or it might be something as simple as the instinctive revulsion that cats, my own cat is an exception, feel for vampires. The dead gathered around the golem and me like we were a campfire in a Montana winter. The air grew thick with that not substance that seems to make up their immaterial bodies, and the feel of it vibrated my bones.
"We are like," the golem said. "We guard against evil. You found what magic has hidden from me. A canker, a cancer, a rot at the heart of my territory, and lit me the path here also. Can you destroy these demons?"
If we were going to have a conversation, I needed to be human. I suppose that we could converse without sound, as the golem was not really making sound. But I preferred to use real words, something I could shape with more sureness than the unruly babble that was my usual thought process. The golem's presence initially stirred up some hope that I might make it out of this alive. But by the time I was back in my human skin, the hope had drifted away with the warmth of my vanished fur. The basement was a lot colder when I was kneeling naked in the cage, and the golem was a ghost. At the very least, it was a spirit without form. That it passed through the witch's wards was proof that it could not affect the material world any more than it could be affected by it. I took a deep breath and felt the golem with other senses. It didn't feel quite like a ghost, not quite, which is why I kept trying to identify it as a spirit instead. A different word for the same thing, but not quite. What was left of Rabbi Loeb's golem was very close kin to a ghost. I couldn't figure out if it was the rabbi's magic that made him feel so different, or if it was the magic that felt like Huayota's magic. He, unlike the first time I'd encountered the golem, it felt like a him, so I went with that feeling, had no power, because it had been taken from him by Rabbi Loeb all those centuries ago when the rabbi had stolen back the life he had bestowed. When I had thought of golems, which wasn't often because they are not common back in the Tri-Cities, I had conceived of them as magical robots, an animated bit of stone, obedient to the will of the man who had called them into being. Our earlier meeting in the streets of the old Jewish quarter had shaken that conviction. There had been an element of self-determination and thought that had not belonged to a robot. And no robot ever had a spirit that traveled the streets long after the body was gone to dust. Part of me had been working on the puzzle of the golem ever since I'd first met him. I'm no kind of skilled magic user. I didn't know anything at all about the Kabbalistic magic the old rabbi had used to create the Golem of Prague, but I've been exposed to lots of other kinds of magic. Whatever it was now, based on the feel of the magic that surrounded him, I was pretty sure that the golem had started out as a Manitou. Manitou, according to Coyote, yes, that Coyote, are the bits of the spirit of the earth. The whole earth has an enormous Manitou. It can stir as one spirit, but it is too large to be concerned with minor things. Mostly the earth's Manitou sleeps. And all of us should thank our lucky stars, that is true. Each dandelion or pebble has a bit of that Manitou, a bit that is fully independent of the whole. But the Manitou of a dandelion is very small and does not have much power to affect things around it. The mountains and lakes also have Manitou. Theirs are powerful and tend, like Mother Earth's greater Manitou, to be dangerous when roused. Mostly, that doesn't happen a lot. As he explained it, Coyote and his fellow avatars are very closely related to Manitou, like a horse and a jackass. He flashed me a wicked grin as I lay in a hospital bed, put there by Huayota, who was, again according to Coyote, the Manitou of a great volcano. I might not be an expert on Kabbalistic magic, but I was pretty sure that Rabbi Lov, who had created the golem, had found a Manitou from something in between a mountain and a pebble. It had been strong enough to become the golem, but small enough to be controlled by a man who worked Kabbalistic magic. It had probably not been the Manitou of the Voltava, which would be huge and powerful. Maybe it was from some long-buried stream or hill, or something native to the earth of Yosefov. To me, such an act would have been evil. He had enslaved a living spirit. I doubted that a man European-born and bred would have thought of the spirit as living. He would have considered it magical energy, maybe. That a Manitou spirit was naturally territorial would only have helped the rabbi's magic along. The rabbi was a good man in all the stories I ever heard. If he'd known what he'd done, I was sure he'd have been appalled. But most Judeo-Christian churches do not believe in Manitou. He had, as I had previously, thought of the golem as a robot, an object without feelings or true life. When the rabbi had, to go with the robot analogy, turned the golem off, he locked the Manitou in an artificial and uncomfortable existence, dead, but not dead. Partially, I thought, by the way the off switch had worked. Depending upon the story, probably because there were several ways to power a golem, Rabbi Lov had carved into the golem's forehead the word Emet, which is the Hebrew word for truth. When the rabbi deactivated the golem, he removed a letter and left the word Met, which is dead. The problem with this, as I saw it, was that a Manitou cannot die. It just is, like the sun and the rain. It can be changed or hidden, but it cannot be killed. But the rabbi's magic imbued the death command too strongly for the golem to ignore, so it could not live, either. In my head and without real words, the golem had been following my thought process. I couldn't tell if he agreed with my assessment or not, or even if he understood it, but something made him speak.
"Neither spirit nor golem nor ghost," he told me, "but at the same time all of them together. I kept watch over the streets of Prague. I was helpless to do anything against human evil or things like the vampires, those who could neither see nor sense me. But I was driven to do this thing that I could not. Rabbi Lov gave me the task of keeping Yosefov safe. So I drifted through the night streets of Prague, able neither to forsake my task nor accomplish it. And then I encountered you. Afterward, I frightened a thief away, I, who no one could perceive before. You did something to me, made me more real, real enough to rip a door off its hinges."
His interaction with me had lit up my magic until I'd been swamped, almost literally, by ghosts anywhere near me. That was another reason I thought the golem had been created from a Manitou. If we weren't as closely related as a horse and a jackass, then he probably wouldn't have affected me that way. I hadn't considered what it had done to him. The golem returned to his original question.
"Can you destroy these demons?"
I gave a disbelieving laugh. "Does it look like I am in a position to do anything to the vampires?" The cage was coated with silver, which mattered not a whit to me, but the metal welded mesh was strong. The holes were too fine to allow me to stick more than a pair of fingers through it. If someone handed me the key to the padlock, I couldn't have unlocked it from inside. I patted the cage door. But even if I were out and free, I'd be no match for them. I'm not a power golem. The golem made a rumbling sound that made the vampire on the wall flinch.
"You are the one who walks the path of the dead," he told me. "The dead must hear you and obey. These demons, these vampires, have swallowed death to stay on this earth. They are not exempt from your power."
In one brief statement, the golem had clarified something that I'd been working through my whole life, that my kind had a purpose, a reason for existence. I stared at the golem and sucked in a breath of air. I reminded myself that my kind originated on another continent. The golem could not have encountered someone like me.
I know what you are, the golem said. Mercy.
Again, it wasn't my name. It was bigger than that. It fit better. To him I said carefully, My experience is that I might be able to make one vampire obey me, and only for a very short time. But there are a lot of vampires in this place. I could feel the weight of them. The vampire on the wall screamed at me again, as he had been doing off and on since the vampires who'd caught me had stuck me in the cage. This time it made me jump, because he'd been quiet a while, and I'd been paying attention to the golem. I turned to him, and pulling on the authority I'd been learning to use in the pack, said, Quiet. He screamed louder and with more feeling. I said it again. As I did, the golem reached through the cage and touched my chest. Power flooded me, and the vampire shut his mouth. Quit looking at me, I whispered, pushed by the golem's wishes rather than my own, and the vampire turned his head away. I clamped my mouth shut. It was wrong to do that, to have that kind of power over someone, even a vampire, and to use it as if they weren't a thinking being, to give them no choice but to listen to me. A cold hand stroked my shoulder. One of the ghosts had crawled in beside me and touched me. I shivered, but I didn't give it any orders. Cooperation is one thing, enslavement is another. I knew better than Rabbi Lov, so there was no excuse for me when I did it. Not that I had never forced a ghost to obey me. Ghosts weren't the humans whose death had birthed them. But I was increasingly uncomfortable with the assumption that that meant they weren't alive anymore. And that meant that other than for my own defense or in defense of someone else, I could not bind them to my will again. If my whisper could influence the vampire as strongly as it had, no ghost had a chance of resisting me. The vampire, not looking at me, began to jerk on his chains. Clank, clank, clank. He kept going with the steady reliability of a drum major. Clank, clank, clank. See, I said to the golem. He's working his way out of it. Imagine if I were trying to control a dozen of them, and he's crazy. I don't think that helps him resist me. The golem looked back at me. He didn't have eyes. I saw him more with my other senses than I saw him with my eyes, but I could feel his regard.
I have a counter-proposal, he said. I have had a very long time to think about what I could manage. My master worked his magic in front of me and taught his students in front of me. I have knowledge, but no power.
I can't help you there, I said. I have no power to give you.
Do you not?
The golem turned his attention to the ghost beside me. She shrank away from him, huddled against my side as if she thought I might help her. I don't know how long she'd been a ghost, maybe a day, maybe a century. She could have been a victim of the vampires or the Nazis, or one of the pogroms that had inspired Rabbi Lov to protect the Jewish quarter with a golem. I could see 20 or 30 ghosts clearly enough to see their faces. Another dozen were wisps of whatever substance ghosts are made of. But beyond them, I could feel them filling the room. I realized I was paying attention to them because the golem wanted me to.
Don't you? Asked the golem again. Feed them to me, and I can go remake myself. I know how to do it, so I can protect my territory again.
Feed them to you? I asked.
Feed me the ghosts, he said, as if he thought I hadn't understood him the first time.
No, I told him. They don't belong to me. As if to disagree, the ghost who clung to my side put her face against my shoulder and wept silently. Her tears ran down my shoulder.
Feed them to me. I will clean this place of the vermin who prey upon my people. If you tell them, the ghosts, to let me eat them, they will give themselves to me.
He paused.
I cannot get them to do that, though I have tried since you and I met, and I conceived of this possibility.
I opened my mouth to answer, but at the top of the stairs the doorknob turned. The ghosts left more quickly than they had come. I shifted to Coyote, and waited to meet Mary, and discover just how bad a fix I was in. I had been very sure of my answer to the golem before Mary's visitation, but Kosurik's information, changed everything.
As soon as Mary and her cadre took their leave, I changed back to human and looked at the golem who'd observed the whole thing undetected. I did not order the dead to give themselves up to the golem. Apparently he needed their consent, but he did not need their informed consent, or even their willing consent. But I did. Because unlike Rabbi Loew, I knew what I was doing. I knew the difference between good and evil, and I knew that the humans on this planet were not the only ones deserving of being treated under the "do unto others as you would have done unto you" clause of good behavior. I called the ghosts to us, not just those who had come initially, drawn by the combination of our presence together. I called all the ghosts I could sense. When the golem touched me to reach farther, I accepted it. This was a horrible thing to do, and the only thing more horrible would be to take everything from those who had only a little existence left and have it not be enough to get the job done. They came, filling the basement impossibly deep, until I breathed shallowly in an attempt not to breathe them in with the air I needed to live. "Listen," I told them. As with Libor's ghosts and the golem, there was no language barrier between me and the dead here. They fell silent, and I could feel their attention, like the sun on the back of my neck in the summer. "I have an offer for you," I told them. "It will mean that you will cease to exist here. I do not know what that means exactly to you or for you." I explained what we needed and why, ignoring the golem's impatience. I think about half of them understood me. The others were too fragmented to reason or communicate what they thought, even if they could comprehend what I told them. Some of them were old, older than the apartment building, and they kept coming as I talked, until the weight of their presence dropped the temperature in the basement, until I could see my breath and frost formed on the metal of the cage. I explained everything twice. When I had finished, I waited. The weight of the dead was heavy on my chest. "Yes," they said as one, those who could speak. "Feed him," I said, and the golem's power gave my voice more authority somehow, both an order and a spellcrafting that was of the golem's making. They came to him. There were ghosts so lifelike I could have mistaken them for the living. There were others who were reduced to an emotion or a single moment of time. Still more I could only sense and not see, even with the augmentation the golem provided. The golem's spirit surrounded them, sucked them into his darkness, until only one remained, the young woman who had stayed by my side through Mary's visit. She hid her face from the golem.
"That one too," he said.
"No,"
she whispered in my ear, sending a chill across my skin that raised goosebumps. "No," I told him. "Only those who were willing."
"I need them all," he thundered, in a voice that made my bones ache.
I didn't say anything more. Her tears were real enough now that I could feel them slide down the naked skin of my shoulder. The golem wasn't solid, not yet, but his presence thickened the air as he leaned his will against mine, and lost. Eventually, he left. I told myself that I would not have given the dead to the golem had I not found that Mary was doing something even worse than I'd believed possible. I told myself that the evil in Prague was my business, because if word of what Mary had managed got out, it would affect everyone. Every human, every vampire, and every person in between. The vampires, long subdued because of the difficulty of making more of themselves, would jump at the chance to increase the speed and effectiveness of their procreation. They would recruit witches. I tried to imagine Elisaveta as a vampire, and stopped myself, because I really needed to think and not rock back and forth in the corner of my cage. The newly created vampires apparently had a shelf life with an explosion at the end, so it wouldn't be long before the humans noticed. There would be war. I was old enough to remember the rampant paranoia about the Fae when they came out. I remember mobs in small towns burning down the houses of their neighbors on suspicion that someone was Fae. I remember people being torn apart. There was a reason that when the Fae proposed forming reservations, the government had no trouble making that happen. And the Fae, especially the Fae as they had represented themselves at the time, were not considered predators. They did not need to kill humans to live. Vampires did. Lots and lots of people, all kinds of people, would die if the human population decided to believe that vampires were real, the way that the Fae and the werewolves were real. I think one of the reasons that Bran had held out so long before allowing the werewolves to come out was that he knew that people who believed in werewolves would have less trouble believing in vampires. So there was a very good reason to loose the golem on the vampires and hope he did not continue on to the unsuspecting inhabitants of Prague. Rabbi Love had tried to kill the golem in the end. I remembered the rake of the golem's fingers across my face and the burning pain he'd left behind. I was very much afraid that the real reason I had done as the golem asked was because I could not bear what would happen to Adam if I died here. My faith was strong enough to believe with confidence that death was not the end. Torture was nothing I looked forward to. We had a wolf in the pack who'd been tortured by witches, but there would be an end to it. But Adam I worried about. I had promised him once that I would do everything I could do to live, to survive for his sake. I was still bound by that promise. Yes, I would have asked the ghosts to sacrifice themselves, would have given the golem the means to remake himself all for Adam's sake. That there were other very good reasons for it only made it easier, but it didn't make me a better person. Rats scurried around the edges of the cellar, confused, I think, by me. They might not know what a coyote was, but they knew all about dogs, and I worried them despite the call of freshly bleeding corpses. I put my muzzle down on my front paws and closed my eyes. After all the energy I'd expended, I was hungry. But behind the mesh of the cage, I wasn't going to go hunting rats, and they weren't going to be nibbling on me, either. I waited for the golem, and hoped. Hoped I'd done the right thing. Hoped that it worked as the golem expected it would. Hoped that, burdened with a physical body, he could still find his way through the witchcraft to find this place. Hoped that he would be a match for the vampires in this place. Hoped that something good would come of this. But mostly, I worried.
10. Adam.
Adam's story continues at daybreak of the first morning he spent in Milan. At this time, I got to my feet, put on my clothes, and went out to find the cafe that had free Wi-Fi so I could try to contact someone. Adam and his people have retreated to their assigned rooms.
Adam knew a dozen ways to deal with a time zone shift, but mostly he'd found that staying up when he had to stay up, and sleeping whenever he could, took care of fatigue eventually. He hoped not to be in Europe long enough to adjust. Since their host was a vampire, that meant they went to bed at dawn. The good news was that since his inner clock was already screwed up from the time change to Europe, adding the whole switch from functioning in the night rather than the day was just a blip. He didn't like that their party was split up, but there had been no way to include Harris and Smith without indicating that he didn't trust Buonarroti's ability to keep his people safe. Adam was pretty sure Buonarroti could keep his vampires under control if he wanted to. He just didn't trust that Buonarroti wanted to keep Adam's people safe. He also wasn't sure that letting Buonarroti think they were all one big traveling sex orgy was helping their cause. The meal they'd spent with the vampires made him suspicious that Marsilia's act was mostly because of matters between her and Buonarroti, and had nothing to do with consolidating the sleeping space for defensive reasons. He was pretty sure that Buonarroti, for all that he was as jealous as a cat whose owner had two dogs, knew they weren't sleeping together in any but the most mundane sense of the word. Any werewolf worth his salt could have figured it out. There was something about body language and scent that made such things obvious. At least her machinations had reduced his patrol area to two. His two outliers were only down a short hall and up a staircase from them. Adam wasn't happy. It was too far for tactical safety. Smith's victim-like demeanor made him a target in this house of predators. If something happened in Harris's room, Adam was pretty sure he'd hear the screams from the big suite. It didn't make the beast who lived in his heart content, or Adam either, but it was the hand he had been dealt.
"Dawn is coming,"
said Marsilia as Stefan closed the door of the suite. The two vampires had volunteered to escort the pilots to their room.
"There isn't much time."
"Rest well," Adam said, though he knew that it wasn't a rest at all. The vampires died with the rising of the sun. Stefan, who had followed Marsilia as she walked rapidly toward their room, paused to give Adam a wry smile. "Stay safe," he said, then disappeared through the doorway behind Marsilia. Larry rubbed his hands together thoughtfully, staring at the door that had just been closed behind their vampires. But when he spoke, it wasn't directly about Marsilia or Stefan. "I think that went about as well as could be expected," he said. Then he said what Adam had just been thinking. "I'm not sure anyone but a love-struck fool, which Bonarata isn't quite, would think there was anything between you and Marsilia. But the Lord of Night was plenty jealous, anyway, for what it's worth. I heard you open Bonarata's eyes about the relationship between the Maroc and your wife. Is it true? Would the Maroc still go to war for her?" If the goblin had heard all of that, he not only could hear as well as any werewolf Adam had ever met, he also had a larger capacity to sort through data than Adam had. The conversations in the dinner hall had blurred to incomprehensible for Adam. He nodded in response to the goblin's question. "Brand would not be pleased if something happened to Mercy. Very not pleased." Larry tilted his head in a way that was neither human nor quite wolf-like.
Bran was Grendel?
He thought about Larry the Goblin King and how everyone underestimated goblins. He decided it would be a good thing if the Goblin King knew something of what the Maroc was.
"Not quite," Adam said.
"As I understand it, Beowulf was written down a long time after the events it purports to tell. The purpose of the story, as it was recorded, was to recite the final deeds of Beowulf, a great hero. Somewhere along the way, someone put him up against the scariest monsters they'd ever heard of, instead of the terrible monsters who did kill him. That tale then blended back to the original. On one remarkable night, not long after Adam had been changed, the Maroc's son, Samuel, had sung, then translated, several versions of the tale of Beowulf. Beowulf, Adam told the goblin, isn't any more accurate than any story told by mouth for centuries before it was written down, which is not very. Bran's story is that a long time ago he was broken. It had something to do with protecting his son. For a very long time afterward, decades and maybe longer, Bran was a mindless monster who killed every living thing in his territory.
When you were talking to Jacob, you said Bran's mother was a witch, said Elisaveta.
He hadn't. She was fishing. So he said, Bran has never said so. I've heard the rumors, though. So has Bonarata. Samuel had told him that Bran's mother was a witch, and Adam figured that, being Bran's son, Samuel had been in a position to know. But he didn't have to tell Elisaveta who his source was. If Bran had wanted it to be known that he was witch-born, he'd have told everyone himself. Since he hadn't, Adam wasn't going to do it for him. But everyone had heard the rumors, and those Bran encouraged. Adam just didn't need to confirm them.
Interesting, she said thoughtfully. It would explain some things if it were true.
She smiled wickedly at Adam.
Some things that others have tried to do to Bran Cornick and failed miserably.
He didn't want to know, especially because she wanted to tell him. Elisaveta was one of his, but that didn't mean he didn't know what she was, witch, and all that entailed. He wouldn't invite her to bring her brand of horror to their suite, and it did not matter to him in the slightest that it was only Larry and Honey here, and they could protect themselves.
Be that as it may,
Elisaveta said when it became clear he wasn't going to question her. He could tell she was disappointed with him for spoiling her fun, though she knew him better than to have expected him to allow her to play her games here.
I am an old woman, and I've been up for far too long. I'm going to bed and going to sleep.
Wait, he said impulsively. Can you help me contact Mercy again? It was maddening the way the faintness of their bond told him nothing except that she was alive. Lizaveta sighed.
I can, but it is not easy, Adya. And I do not think that it is wise to do not easy magic in the home of one such as Buonarrota unless it is necessary. Especially since such an effort will weaken me in this place where we might need every bit of power all of us can muster. Is there something that makes you think this is necessary?
He gave her a tight smile. Nothing more than that she is on her own, without friends or money, alone in Europe.
Your mate is good at finding friends wherever she goes, Elisaveta said with a little acid.
Elisaveta was not herself a friend of his mate.
She escaped Buonarrota. I expect she can look after herself for a day or two.
Looking after her is my job, he thought. But he said, I expect you're right. But even so, I might ask it of you at a later time, if the wolf demanded it. She nodded.
That is fine, so long as you know what you risk. I bid you all good night.
Wake me, Adya, if anything interesting happens.
I will if I can, he promised. After Elisaveta's door closed, Larry gave Adam a measured look, then waved casually at Adam and Honey before he went into the room Elisaveta had picked for him. He closed his door, too, leaving Honey and Adam alone. Adam considered staying in human guise. After daylight, it was unlikely that he'd run into trouble from the vampires. But vampires have allies, and this one had a werewolf under his thumb. His wolf form was the better one to face a true attack. Unlike less dominant wolves, he could shift back and forth several times in a day, though having the pack so far away would limit that a bit. He began stripping out of his clothes. Honey made a sound as he pulled off his suit jacket, and he looked at her.
"Is it legal for you to carry that in Italy?" she asked. "And what did you do to the scent? I didn't smell it. Still don't."
"Not legal, no," he said, taking off his shoulder holster and the HKP-2000 that was his usual concealed carry. "But who's going to try to arrest me? If they do, they're going to be more worried about the werewolf than the gun."
"So they should," she conceded. She frowned. "Your shaving lotion smell is different." "Does that have something to do with my not picking up the gun scent?"
"Elisaveta," Adam said. "Not much magic, mostly just something that smells a little like gunpowder and oil. That isn't." Honey took a deep breath. She nodded and didn't say anything else. Honey was like that. She didn't mind quiet and only said what she had to say. He stripped off the rest of his clothing, laying the suit across a chair for the night. Everything else he folded on the chair seat. When he was naked, he changed. Honey followed his example without a word. When the whole painful business was over, he curled up on the rug in front of the fireplace, checked that somewhere Mercy was still tethered to him, and settled in to wait. Honey hopped on the couch and put her head on the arm with a deep sigh. He drifted into the light doze that would leave the wolf on alert to any changes but still allow him to rest. It was something that he'd learned to do in Vietnam when he had been a soldier and not a werewolf. The wolf just made it more effective. It was late morning when his phone rang. Grumbling, he rose to his feet and stalked to the table where his satellite phone rested. He knocked it to the floor where it would be easier to see and looked at the display. Ben. The phone quit ringing, and a few moments later a text message popped up, urgent. He checked his bond, and Mercy was still there. He could breathe again without his chest hurting. The urgent didn't go away, it just became more manageable. So he could breathe, but worry still hung on. A host of possibly urgent things popped into his mind. Maybe something had happened to the children. And when had Aiden become one of his children? Aiden, who was older than, well, probably older than Bran. For all that he looked like, he belonged in elementary school. Speaking of Aiden, maybe he'd finally succeeded in burning the house down. It was bound to happen one of these days. Change with speed, then, he decided. It hurt more when he forced it, especially without the pack to draw upon. Honey whined, and he realized that he was automatically pulling energy from her. He stopped that, and his change slowed. Growling, he redoubled his efforts, and in something under 10 minutes by his phone's reckoning, he was in human form, naked, covered in sweat, shivering from pain and shock that made the warmish room feel chilly, but human. He picked up the phone without bothering to dress and called Ben. "Yes?"
"Hey,"
Ben said cheerfully. "We are sodding and shagging in honey, Adam. Mercy stole an e-book reader from the Dark Ages and used it to contact me via Gmail. She's in the Czech Republic. I think they call it Czechia for short now. Prague." And it took a moment for Adam to breathe again, but when he did, the air was sweet. He collected himself, aware of Ben waiting patiently on the other side of the phone connection.
Prague?
He did a quick check of his mental map of Europe and blinked. "That's what, 500 miles from here?" That was some bus ride, Mercy. No wonder his bond was so weak. Without the pack, he was surprised he could touch her at all.
"About that," agreed Ben blandly. "I contacted Charles, and he told me to put her in touch with Libor of the Vultava pack. I haven't heard back from her, but the e-reader was out of juice, and she apparently didn't steal the charger when she took the reader."
Prague. Adam took a deep breath. He'd have to wait for Marsilia and Stefan to wake up. He couldn't abandon them in Buonarotti's care. He took another breath and tried to subdue the wolf, who wanted to go right the hell yesterday. "She's okay?" he asked.
"She's okay," Ben assured him. "I told her you were hot on her ass to Europe. She'll hunker down with Libor for a couple of days."
Adam pinched his nose, a habit he'd gotten from watching Bran do it one too many times.
"Tell me about Libor." "Alpha of the Vultava pack. Been around since the middle fucking ages. Apparently a baker, of all the sodding things for a fearsome alpha to be. We are all glad we don't have to tell people our alpha is a mother-humping baker."
Adam made an encouraging sound and waited for Ben to quit distracting himself. As the other wolf got back to matters at hand, Adam filtered out the expletives that were Ben's attempt to shrug off an upper-crust but hellish upbringing. Adam was able to assume from Ben's casual attitude that various people weren't really pedophiles, nor did they do interesting and unlikely things with animals and or machinery. When Ben was finished, he left Adam with something worth worrying about. "Libor has a legendary grudge against Bran," Adam said slowly. "Charles doesn't know what it was about. Did you try Samuel?" Surely one of the two would have the story.
"Sorry," Ben said regretfully. "I did try. Since it was I sending Mercy into the mouth of the monster, I decided I was on the need-to-know list. Took an act of God to get in touch. Samuel doesn't know. Charles says he doesn't know what it was. All he has is a couple of comments Bran made once upon a time, and Bran won't say anything more. Apparently there was an oath involved, and you know how Bran is about that."
Adam cursed under his breath.
"How many years in the army, and that's all you've got?" Ben said. "I thought the army guys really know how to swear."
Despite everything, Adam grinned at the phone. "We didn't swear in my day," he lied. "We just killed people."
"There is that," said Ben. "What can I do? Samuel says he can head to Prague, but it will take him a couple of days to get there. Apparently he's in Africa."
"I thought he and Ariana were in the UK, Adam said.
"He said he was doing a favor for an old friend," Ben said. "Medical, I think, and not werewolf or fae business. They're not in a civilized area, and it will take a day to hike out."
Adam thought about that. "Tell Samuel no. It sounds like the crisis is mostly over. Does Charles have a way for me to contact Libor?" Trouble between the Prague Alpha and Bran or not, the vampires were a real threat. Though he, like Larry, thought he'd convinced Buonarroti that killing Mercy would be a mistake. Still, he'd be happier to put Mercy with allies just in case.
"I can get that," Ben promised. "I'll text it to you in the next 15 minutes. That work?"
"That works," he said. He ended the call and paced, restlessly, waiting for Ben's text message. Eventually, he put clothes on. As soon as Ben sent over the information, Adam called the Alpha of the Vultava Pack, the Alpha of Prague. It took a few minutes to get Libor on the phone, which was only to be expected. Adam happened to pace by a mirror as he was waiting, and stopped when he noticed that his eyes were bright gold. It would be a mistake to let his wolf do the negotiations with another Alpha. He practiced the breathing exercises he'd learned to help his control. By the time Libor came to the phone, he was under control. It took a while to negotiate a language to speak in. Libor pretended not to speak English because English was Adam's native tongue. They both spoke Russian, but Libor still held a grudge against the Russians. German was out of the question for the same reason, for which Adam was grateful because his German wasn't good enough for delicate negotiations. Finally, Adam said in English, "Look, I'm an American. You're lucky I have two languages I'm fluent in. We can do this in English or Russian, or I can find a translator. That will complicate things worse than they already are, especially since where I am, the most likely translator I can find will be a vampire." He could do basic Vietnamese and Mandarin, but he bet that neither of those were in Libor's repertoire. And Adam hadn't used either language in several decades. "Russian," conceded Libor without pause. He'd probably already come to the same conclusion Adam had voiced, but he'd waited for Adam to point out his inadequacies. That was fair, because it was Adam who was going to ask for a favor. Ben had said that Libor was a man of his word, but he was as slippery as a Grey Lord. Adam preferred to work with straightforward people, even if they were enemies, instead of subtle, slippery allies. But that wasn't his choice to make at this point. Bonorata and Mercy between them had brought him to this pass. That didn't mean Adam needed to follow Libor's game. Instead of working up to what he wanted, he just said, "My maid is in Prague by herself on the run from Bonorata, with whom I am currently in negotiations. She needs a safe place to await help. I should be able to be there." "An hour," said the wolf, "probably two. We could fly to her in a couple of hours." Adam closed his eyes and forced himself to remember that two of his people were currently vulnerable until nightfall. That he was in negotiations with Bonorata, which were not going to benefit from a hasty departure. Those negotiations were necessary to keep his family and his people safe. Bonorata and Adam still hadn't come to any kind of agreement about the situation, whatever it really was, that had made Bonorata decide to take a shot over the bow at Mercy. He wasn't going to see Mercy today, not today. "Early tomorrow morning at the latest," he said. "You lost your maid?" said Libor in an amused voice. Across the room, the mirror showed gold flooding Adam's eyes, and he bit back a growl. "I know exactly where she is," Adam said carefully. "I will come for her shortly. It would be useful to have a quiet place for her to rest until I can come." There, he backed down from "need" to "it would be useful to."
"I need more detail than what you have given me," Libor said. "I have to protect my pack first."
So Adam went through the whole scenario from the moment the vampires had hit Mercy in his car right up to their current situation. Edited, but still most of the story.
"I see," said Libor, when Adam had finished.
There was a long silence, presumably as Libor weighed what Adam had told him. Then he said,
"You managed to let your mate get kidnapped by the most ruthless vampire on the planet, and now you need my help."
Yes. That need had been a mistake. Hard to judge words when he wasn't face to face with the other werewolf. If it had been Bran he'd been talking to, need would have been the key word. Bran didn't turn away werewolves who needed him. Libor had just downgraded himself in Adam's book of evaluation. But Adam hadn't spent his formative years in the Army Rangers for nothing. He knew how to manipulate arrogant asses even better than he could manipulate competent commanders, the former having been much more common in his experience than the latter. "If you are afraid of the vampires," Adam said, "I understand. Mercy can take care of herself just fine." He fiercely believed that. It was the only reason he was still here, doing his duty in protecting those who'd trusted him enough to follow him into the den of the boogeyman of the vampires, instead of grabbing one of the pilots and making a beeline for Prague. She got away from Bonorata with nothing more than her brains and determination. She won't have any trouble surviving your streets for a day, I'm not so sure if your streets will survive, though. He thought of Marsilius rubbing Mercy's escape in Buonarrota's face and said, My mate hit Buonarrota's pet werewolf with a bus. I wonder what she'll do to your territory on her own. The other werewolf growled and bit out.
I do not fear the vampires. Buonarrota was a child when I was an old wolf, and his territory is far from here. Very well, we will protect her from Bonarata's vampires until you come for her. Where shall I find your mate?
Mercy will find you, Adam said, satisfied at having goaded the other into defending himself. They were both aware that whatever the limits of Bonarata's territory, his fingers were in the business of every town in Europe. Libor's words were hollow, and they both knew it. Anyone within 1,000 miles of Buonarrota should feel a healthy amount of fear. But Adam chose to be conciliatory. I appreciate your aid in this situation. Libor disconnected without further words. Adam stared at the phone. For 2 cents, he'd drop everything and go find Mercy. Now. Mercy could take care of herself. She'd survived just fine before he'd married her. Afterward, both he and she had done all that they could to ensure that continued to be true. He could trust her to take care of herself. But when he started to make another call, he knew the wolf was in his eyes again. He didn't bother trying to calm down. David, he said as soon as the other side of the phone call was picked up, I need to land a private jet in or very near Prague. Do you know somewhere I can do that? David Christensen, the werewolf on the other side of the conversation, was a mercenary with contacts all over the world. He was also one of Adam's oldest friends.
How are you, Adam? David said with mock cheer. It's good to talk to you. Even, hi, hello, how's it going would have been okay.
Mercy's loose in Prague. I'm in Milan, and I need to get to Prague tomorrow morning. Very early. Money is no problem, but if the price is too high, we might need to wire some. David wasn't stupid. He heard Milan and that Mercy and Adam were separated. He added those two together and came up with Buonarrota because he said,
Messing in vampire business isn't for wusses. Try to look unimportant, Sarge. Maybe they'll be low on ammo.
Too late, Adam said with an involuntary grin. He hadn't heard that phrase since Nam when officers were favorite targets of the enemy. But there aren't any bullets flying right now. In the background, he could hear the scratch, scratch, as David wrote something on a piece of paper.
What kind of plane?
Adam gave him the specs, and David wrote those down, too.
Give me a minute. My people are on it, David said. If you kill that old bastard in Milan, I'll treat you to the biggest steak in Chicago. Or Seattle, if you don't want to come my way.
Doesn't look like murdering vampires is in my near future, admitted Adam, much as I'd enjoy it. David murmured something to someone else. Then was back on the phone.
Got it. Do you have something to write with, or do you want me to text you?
Text me, said Adam. Thanks.
I still owe you, I figure, David responded. You need some backup? I can be in Prague with a crew or two in about 17 hours.
Adam considered it. But if the people he had with him weren't enough, he reckoned he'd need a nuclear strike and not more people to die trying to rescue him and Mercy. I think it's handled, he said, though he'd have been happier if Libor had been the same kind of polite liar that Buonarrota was. Odd that he trusted the vampire further than his own kind. But he'd met Buonarrota, and he figured he had his measure. No telling whether Libor was just being a pain for the sake of annoyance, or if he was a problem.
Let me know if that changes, said David. Keep your head down.
You too. They disconnected. And Adam was left with a whole day to get through and nothing to do. Sleeping was out of the question. Honey was awake and watching him. She'd have heard everything. She wagged her tail and smiled hopefully. Adam ran his hands through his hair. Right. This is good news. Mercy is safe. I'm pretty sure Buonarrota believed me about Bran, and put a call out to his hunters before he went down for the day. He isn't interested in the kind of war Bran would bring him.
The kind where everyone loses.
He smiled at Honey because he knew she'd understand. It's just that now that I know where she is, I'm not sure I can find the patience to wait and talk and talk and talk without killing someone. Honey's ears flattened with amused agreement. She wasn't fond of talk and talk and talk either.
I'm going to notify the pilots that we're flying to Prague before morning tomorrow, Adam said, because it would give him something to do besides pace restlessly. He'd wake them up when they should be getting sleep, but he was paying them enough money that he didn't feel too bad about that.
Stay alert, he told Honey.
She put her nose down on the couch and watched as he put his shoulder holster back on and resettled his suit. He took a good look at himself in the mirror to check for wrinkles, lopsided tie, or the gun printing too obviously. Satisfied that he was as put together as he was likely to get, he left the room. He couldn't lock it behind him without locking himself out. They hadn't been issued keys. He opened the door again and looked at Honey.
Remember, the door won't be locked until I get back. Keep an ear out, he said.
Then he left his chicks safe in her care. His mouth turned up as he thought about what any of the people in that suite would think of his considering them in need of his care. Except for Elisaveta, of course. She would accept his concern as her due, if only a small part of her considerable defenses. Adam climbed briskly up the hardwood stairs, turned the corner, and knocked on the door. Movement exploded within.
It's me, he told them, low-voiced, which is probably what he should have done in the first place.
A moment, said Harris tightly. I've got some safeguards in place. Give me a moment.
Good, thought Adam. The door opened, and Adam stepped inside, closing himself inside. It wasn't a suite or even a good hotel room, but there was room for two twin beds, two chests of drawers, and a TV. It was clean, and there was a big window looking out on the same courtyard the main room of the suite did. From up here, he could see over the wall and out to the villa next door. Matt Smith was sitting cross-legged in his bed with his back to the wall. He looked interested, but not particularly concerned.
We found Mercy, Adam told him.
Harris's eyebrows climbed.
How did you manage that? Bonorata's people are asleep now, surely.
Adam shook his head.
I should have said Mercy found us.
She evidently stole an e-book reader with Wi-Fi, found a cafe with free Wi-Fi, and spent the next 10 minutes in frantic conversation via email with one of my wolves before the battery in the e-reader died. She's in Prague.
Prague?
Said Smith. Adam nodded. Since I was out of reach, Ben consulted the Maroc's son, Charles, who told him to send her to the local Alpha for protection.
Libor? Said Smith. I've heard things about Libor of the Voltava.
Charles recommended him, said Adam.
Oh, sorry, Smith said. Probably okay then, right? Charles doesn't make mistakes.
Harris looked back and forth between the two werewolves.
Trouble?
I called Libor and confirmed he'd provide safe space for Mercy until I could get there tomorrow morning, Adam said when Smith didn't say anything.
If that's dangerous, if you know something, Smith, this would be the time to let me know.
Smith shook his head.
No, Libor is a man of his word. If he told you she'd have safety with him, she will.
We could be in Prague in an hour and a half, said Harris. Maybe a little longer. Do you have a place I can set down there? If not, I have a place to land in Brno and another in Dresden. And it's only a couple of hours by car from either one to Prague. We could use the main airport, but that might be more public than we want to be.
I have a place for you to land in Prague, Adam said.
Not a good idea to offend Bonorata, suggested Smith quietly. If you leave without clearing it with him, you are putting him in a corner in which he has no choice but to call you an enemy for breaking guesting custom.
Harris gave his co-pilot a sharp look.
Adam smiled at the goblin's surprise.
Remember that werewolves can live a long time, and just because one is submissive doesn't make them stupid. My experience has suggested the opposite. We have a saying, listen when the soft ones speak.
Smith smiled with only a little irony.
Your maid has a reputation of her own, said Smith. Do you think she needs your help?
My feeling after the dinner was that Bonorata intends to diplomatically forget about Mercy.
Did you overhear something? Adam asked alertly.
Smith ran his hands through his hair, glanced up at Adam, and then away.
He told one of his vampires, the woman with red and gold hair, to call off the hunt. Unless he's found someone else to hunt. I suspect that's the hunt.